tonight on Arena. And Marina Curran and Kit the Wall on the importance of telling the unheard stories. And we preview Timothy Spall and Aina Hardwick in the new drama, The Sixth Commandment. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The Errigal Arts Festival is underway at the moment in Donegal. Regular listeners to this show will no doubt be aware of that. One of the highlights is Telling the Whole Story, Taking Our Place, a panel discussion of writers and activists, which takes place at Rathmullen House on Sunday the 23rd of July at 3 p.m. Chaired by historian Dr. Angela Byrne, the event brings together author Kit Duvall, traveller activist and Senator Eileen Flynn, and poet Anne-Marie Nicorain. They will explore what it means to open the literary and artistic space to voices and experiences previously excluded to women, people of colour, travellers, migrants, the poor, and other minority groups. Joining me now, Anne-Marie Nicorain and Kit Duvall. Delighted to have both of you with us to talk about this event this evening on the programme. Anne-Marie, starting with you, you curated the event. So was there some big idea or big set of questions in your mind as you put the thing together?
Well, the inspiration for the event really comes out of my own experience growing up in the Gaeltacht. Pogu la Gaelic me in Dunamal, Tamanta Broadwell as much Gaelic. I was raised in the Irish language, and that gave me lots of great exposure to storytelling and folklore and legends. And this event is really about exploring that heritage alongside other similarly rich heritages. And crucially, I think when we come together in conversation with Angela Byrne, we'll be talking about, you know, how our different heritages have influenced our desires to tell stories, and what stories we feel moved to tell, and the difficulties and challenges in speaking out of our different heritages.
And when it came to choosing the panellists, how did you go about that? Obviously, we have Kit with us this evening, and also part of the discussion will be the traveller activist, the Senator Eileen Flynn.
Well, I'm a big admirer of the work of both of these voices. Eileen Flynn is a proud traveller woman, and I'm really interested to find out about how her traveller upbringing has shaped her interest in stories. I'm really interested to hear about her exposure to the Shelta language, sometimes called Gammon or Cant. And similarly, Kit, who's joining us today, has a rich Irish Caribbean heritage. And I want to find out, are there commonalities between our experiences and the perspectives that we share? I'm interested to see the richness, I suppose, you know, when we all come together to talk about stories.
Certainly, that's two great heritages that you have at your disposal, Kit, the Irish and the Caribbean. Does one or other of them speak louder than the other? Or to you, is that, that's who I am? It's kind of one heritage, but it's the two things together.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, I am a whole thing, obviously, as all people are. There's no battle inside at all about dominance in my heritage. The West Indian, African Caribbean culture and Irish culture are so similar. You would not believe it. The place of women, the desire to be heard, the crack. I mean, you don't call it crack in the West Indian heritage, but my goodness, it's exactly the same. That is the purpose. There's, you know, like when two black people meet, for example, they say a phrase, Wagwan, which means exactly the same as an Irish person would say. It's saying, tell me a story. It doesn't mean, how are you? Are you well? It means, tell me what's going on, and make it funny. Make it funny. Make it worth hearing. And interestingly as well, the oral tradition in West Indian culture and in Irish culture is very, very strong. When you did your introduction, Sean, you talked about poor people. You never hear that phrase anymore. It's working class. But actually, my heritage is poor. I was a poor child. from the West Indian and the Irish. And so historically not educated, couldn't read, couldn't write. So the oral tradition is so important. And I think that's what we miss out in literary spaces, because that isn't valued anymore.
I'm delighted that you used your, give me the word again, is it Wagon, which sounds kind of like, how's it going?
Yeah, exactly. The actual translation would be, what is going on with you? But it's actually Wagwan. That's what you'd say, Wagwan.
Yeah, and there you go, Anne-Marie. And it's Gajas Gurhug to Gaeligaling Eg to Sanagalev. Lovely that you gave us a bit of Irish. But if you think of Donegal, Gajay Maratatu, what is it about how you are is what that phrase literally means.
Yes.
Absolutely. I'm really excited to explore those crossovers. And I'm delighted that Kit mentioned the oral storytelling as well. And I really feel that can sometimes be devalued in a space where we're often thinking about how text performs on a page, how it looks and how it's shaped. And all of that craft really excites me, but so too does oral storytelling.
The other thing I'm thinking about in the midst of all of that, Kit, you mentioned the place of women, the desire to be heard, both of which I'm guessing are not exactly at the great end of this story that the crack might be, which was the third thing that you mentioned. To what extent is it about this and with the discussion, and are you interested in this whole idea of the stories that haven't been heard? I mean, it's there from your very first novel, My Name is Leon. You might explain the voice that hadn't been heard or that wasn't getting enough airtime, if you like, that you gave us in that award-winning novel.
Yes, My Name is Leon is about a small a boy. It's about a summer of a life, summer in the life of a young boy who is in the care system, who's looked after by the state in foster care. And normally, certainly in the UK, when you talk about these children, it's negative. Oh, one of the foster children broke the law, did this, stole, they're runaways, they're tearaways. You don't hear about the why. And so often when people are excluded from being heard, what you do hear is overwhelmingly negative when they've come to the attention of the police or the courts. And I think what is lovely about this panel is it's an exploration, a chance to talk about the voices that aren't heard in a positive way. It's not, as I know, travellers in Ireland and in the UK get such bad press, and none of the beauty of their heritage, the beauty of their language, the beauty of their storytelling, which I know nothing about. I can't wait to hear that.
Kit mentioning in the case of My Name is Leon, the young boy in care, which brings us directly, I suppose, to the Poison Glen, your recent collection, Anne-Marie. This is you in some ways. I hope I'm not putting words in your mouth here. You're telling your father's story at the story of a young boy in care.
Absolutely. And I suppose I'm kind of looking to hold a space for many of the foster siblings that I had as well growing up. So I can't tell anyone else's story, but what I can do is talk about my experience of having been there at different stages along the journey. So, I mean, Maya Angelou talks about, you know, the agony of the untold story. And I'm very kind of familiar with that atmosphere and being in that space with people who really don't have a voice. So what I've tried to do in The Poison Glen is talk about that untold story, the his story, you know, talk about or I suppose pick apart the history that we have been told and dismantle that a bit and try and come to it with, you know, a personal perspective, but also that perspective, as I said, of coming out of the guilt path of a place of oral storytelling and bringing folklore and legend to that space as well. Because, you know, we tell legends and folklores to make sense of very complex human experiences, and reports are only one type of history, and we can bring these heritage influences to understand these complex histories in more nuanced ways.
I can only imagine, Kit, the type of mythological stories that you had. I know if I had both Irish and Caribbean myth at my disposal, I'd have a great mix of stories that I'd be making up on a regular basis. How does that, particularly the mythological side of things, how does that work in your own writing and in your own storytelling, Kit?
In my own storytelling, I'm really sort of worried and nervous around anything mystical. And I think that's because I was brought up as a Jehovah's Witness. And the minute you approach the spiritual with me, I can feel my back go up and I'm thinking, no, I can't do it. However, I did grow up with this tradition, certainly in the West Indian culture, of there being a blurring between this life and the next. Super, super Christian, you know, heavy Christian islands, the West Indies are. But the heritage, obviously, of the slaves that were taken from Africa is very, very rich in, I wouldn't say the supernatural, I'd say the mystic, that sort of blurring between this life and the next life. So that was definitely my heritage. However, I run a mile from it only because I think I might dally into being religious. And you know what? I would love to have a faith that took me into that sphere somehow. And I think I'm just scared of it. Having had it shoved down my throat as a child, I'm scared of it. So I really would like to read that poetry that would talk to me about Irish folklore, which I've definitely missed out on.
And in that respect, Anne-Marie, obviously the church, the Catholic Church in particular, there's so many negative connotations to the teachings of the church and to the effects, the social effects, the social setups of the church, the care homes, the mother and baby homes, one part of that. Where does that sit with you, that relationship with, because I'm interested that Kit is actually saying that the relationship with religion, even though she wants that relationship with the stories, but it's a relationship with religion. Where does that sit with you?
Yeah, I really hear what Kit is saying, and I have had and still have a similar inclination to run from anything that is religious. And that's just kind of my own experience, having grown up in a family that was impacted, I suppose, by the silences of the Catholic Church. My father was born in a mother and baby home. But that said, I've come around to this idea that there's much folklore and legend that predates Catholic Church, that predates Christianity. And I've come into kind of a closer relationship in the last couple of years with very old traditions in Ireland. And, of course, it's complicated in Ireland because we have this kind of blurring between pre-Christian traditions and Christian traditions. And you can see that in things like, St. Bridget or the Holy Wells. And a lot of these traditions were adopted out of a pagan or pre-Christian place into a Catholic place. So for me, I suppose in the last couple of years, it's been a kind of act of reclamation to take back some of that good stuff and to enjoy it for myself. Because in Gaelic tradition, there is often a place held for the feminine divine, for the female archetype who is very strong. And we have to remember that if we throw out kind of the baby with the bathwater, when we're kind of keeping a distance with structures like the Catholic Church, then we're also kind of throwing out a lot of that pre-Christian richness as well. So, I mean, these are all things that we'll be exploring in the discussion.
Yeah.
How do you hold space to critique something like the structures of the Catholic Church, but also how do you enjoy, folklore and pre-Christian customs and traditions as well in your writing?
And also, what you have from religion and from folklore and from history and tradition is a framework for your life, for the big occasions, for birth, death, marriage, sorrow, loss, all of those things that you have a framework for. Someone dies, what happens, where to go, where the focus is, and you have these stories about what happens after death. When you reject history and folklore and that framework, it's a real loss. I would say that for myself, and I don't want that framework. But then what do you do? How do you celebrate? How do you mourn? And I think that's a real loss when you reject I do all of that and put it all in the same box, I think there is a scope for taking some of it back to, as Anne-Marie said, explain the big moments.
One final question to you, Kit, and it links into this idea, I suppose, when you're talking about those big moments, those are often moments that are shared with community, be that a community of family, a community of neighbours, whatever it is. You grew up in Birmingham, in that Irish Caribbean community. Which did you get most stick for at that time? Because I'm guessing both aspects of your tradition were up for grabs in some people's minds.
Yes, so visibly I'm black. So I would say I got the most abuse and discrimination from being a black woman. However, in the 70s, when the IRA bombing campaign was happening, most definitely the Irish community got a lot of stick for that, especially in Birmingham, especially in 1974. Now, that wasn't directed at me because no one looks at me and thinks I'm Irish. But I absorbed it because of my mother, my uncles, my cousins, my community. So although everyone was talking about Irish people in front of me and denigrating Irish people, talking about dirty terrorists, blah, blah, blah. Now, no one's aiming it at me, but I felt it in my soul because I have this identity as an Irish person. So emotionally, I'd say more abuse for being Irish. And yet more obvious abuse or straightforward, direct abuse for being Caribbean.
Did you find yourself needing or wanting or in fact defending the Irish community at that time?
It always depends. So as a child, no, I was scared. I kept my mouth shut and I thought, I'm already getting it in the neck for being black. I think I'll just take a pass on this one. As I got older, and still, if people speak about Irish people in front of me, and it may not always be complimentary. These days, mostly it is, but not always. The Brexit nonsense, and I won't go down that road, did make people think, why won't Ireland do as they're told? I heard that more than once. Mm-hmm. And, well, I won't speak about it, but you can imagine what I said.
Listen, let us finish up with Bloodroot, a poem from you, Anne-Marie, which I think might speak to this whole idea of heritage that we've been talking about.
Absolutely, and it talks to the idea of ceremony as well and ritual. And the landscape has been a real source of consolation for me in moments when I'm trying to make sense of big pictures and big histories and difficulties, and especially in the absence, I suppose, of religious influence as well. So it's a poem written for my foster siblings, and it's titled Bog Medicine. Drink these star-leafed nettles and keep in your purse a fern to become invisible, say your harm to the hill. This hill is pagan, this hill is hill. It will answer in bog tongue and occasional fire, burning back the earth along the heather stream, despite bald heels of rock, despite the kissy mink, despite a saintly air, until the stream runs dark with what needs to blacken out of you.
That's Anne-Marie Nicoran reading her poem Bog Medicine from her collection Bloodroot. Thanks to you, Anne-Marie, Gramila Mahagat, and thanks to you. How do I say thanks to you in a language that makes you feel happy, Kit?
That's a good question. Let me think. Later. It just means whenever. See you whenever.
Okay. Well, later, Kit, as well. That's Kit Duval and Anne-Marie Nicoran. Telling the whole story, Taking Our Place, is at Rathmullen House in County Donegal, Sunday the 23rd of July at 7 p.m. as part of this year's Errigal Arts Festival. There will be music at the event as well, performed on the evening by Mairead O'Donnell, who will have her fiddle along with her. Full details of that and everything happening at the festival, eaf.ie. The 75th Emmy Award nominations were announced in LA today, and some good news for Irish filmmakers within them. Sharon Horgan was nominated for two awards for the critically acclaimed Apple TV series Bad Sisters. The first nomination was for Lead Actress in a Drama Series for her portrayal of the character of Eva Garvey in the series. The other was for Outstanding Writing for a Drama Series, along with fellow writers Dave Finkel and Brett Baer. In the acting category, by the way, Sharon is up against Melanie Linsky for Yellow Jackets, Elizabeth Moss for The Handmaid's Tale, Bella Ramsey for The Last of Us, Kerry Russell's for The Diplomat, and Sarah Snook for Successions. That is quite a set of nominations, isn't it? More good news for Bad Sisters as well, for Dervla Walsh, who received a nomination for Outstanding Directing for a Drama Series. And lastly, Wexford man Declan Lowney, who was nominated for Outstanding Directing for a Comedy Series. This is for his work on Ted Lasso, So Long, Farewell on Apple TV. Succession, by the way, had the highest number of nominations, 27 Emmy nominations. The Last of Us at 24, White Lotus 23, Ted Lasso 21. But congratulations to Sharon Horgan and all the others involved there. Lie Low is a play written by Kira Elizabeth Smith. It was first staged at the Dublin Fringe Festival last year, received such critical acclaim and two Festival Award nominations, one for Best New Writing, the other for Best Performer, which was won by Charlotte McCurry, who plays Faye. Now it is back, this dark, funny and surreal exploration of how the brain works. It's about a young woman, the character of Faye, as I mentioned. She suffers from PTSD following a trauma. Her doctor recommends a form of exposure therapy, so she enlists her brother Nisha to help her. But he has a devastating secret of his own that is about to explode. Lilo will run at the Peacock Theatre in Dublin from the 17th of July next week through until the 29th. Delighted to be joined by the writer herself, Kira Elizabeth Smith. Kira, this show, I mean, it seems like it's the show that keeps on giving for you in some ways. It started off as just a 10-minute play.
It did, yeah. So it started off in 2020 when Peter Reid was organising a festival of short plays in the International Bar in Dublin. And we were just trying to do something, you know, with restrictions on theatre. So he said, you can write a 10-minute piece, no more than two actors, pick your favourite people and we'll put it on. So, yeah, that's where it started. So I wrote a piece originally for Michael Patrick and Aveen McCann, directed by Oisin Kearney.
And
that, we did it and we really enjoyed it. Yeah.
And then at what point did you know that it had to grow from just that 10 minutes into the full length play that you now have?
Well, I mean, the team was a big thing for me. We all got on so well, particularly myself, Michael and Oisin. And yeah, I really wanted to write a piece with a woman at the centre, a very flawed woman, who had experienced a traumatic event and was really trying everything to get over it, to sort of explore the insidious nature of trauma and how it affects and manifests.
Yeah, have we lost you there, Kira? I think we have.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, no, you're back. Sorry.
I thought how it
manifests. Did you say in the midst of that, there was a little bit of breakup, Kira, did you talk about a flawed woman in terms of your description of the character of Faye?
I did, yeah. I think we're dealing with a character that is inherently flawed, like we all are. She's quite a complicated character, but she's had something terrible happen to her. So I was interested in how to navigate that, have a character that's not inherently good or, you know, monotone, deal with a traumatic experience and how to get over it.
And I hope I'm not giving anything away by saying that the traumatic experience that she has experienced is certainly of a sexual nature. Now, when you talk about it, it was why I wanted to clarify that you definitely had spoken about Faye in terms of this flawed woman. What you seem to present here is a situation where things are not black and white. I mean, there isn't a kind of a sexual assault.
Yeah.
It either is a sexual assault or it isn't a sexual assault. But I think you're looking at the grey areas in and around events of this nature. Maybe you'd expand on that a little bit more for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I don't think it's giving anything away to say that the experience was someone broke into her house and essentially exposed himself to her. And I think I suppose the interesting thing for me about that event, and something that's so prevalent in victims of sexual assault, is this notion that it could have been much worse. So you really should get on with things, or you really should be able to get over the experience. But something that's maybe on the lower intensity scale of sexual assault is still incredibly damaging. And I suppose her character was also, she was very drunk at the time. So there's a notion there on how reliable is her memory and how she takes that out in herself.
Yeah, so rather than you saying there are grey areas in and around sexual assault, there are grey areas. People start to put grey areas around things to look for reasons and excuses, when in fact that is not the case.
I mean, absolutely. But then there's also, there's another grey area in the play that they have to navigate. And I think another thing I was interested in is how a victim and perpetrator status can shift seamlessly and without intent, in a way. So there's a lot of grey area in the play, I think.
Yeah, well, I suppose that's where the interesting drama happens, isn't
totally.
It? In the grey area.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the things that Faye is attending a doctor who's advising her on certain ways to behave to try to deal and help with this PTSD that she's suffering with. Exposure therapy is one of the suggestions. Would you explain this to me, and how real a phenomenon is it?
Sure. So exposure therapy is a psychological treatment that's developed to help people confront or reduce their fear or the adverse effects of fear. So in the simplest terms, the theory is that you expose yourself to the source of your fear in a safe and controlled environment as a way to move past it. Now, I think opinion in the medical community on this varies massively. But it has been used to some success for patients. But the success stories that I've read about mainly are about, arachnophobia, where they can people who are afraid of spiders and they can expose themselves to that. But the character, Faye, is sort of at the end of her tether and she'll try anything.
Yeah, well, as you say, you've described the event that she has been, the assault on her. So kind of trying to relive that or to expose yourself to that event again is a very dubious act. And that, again, is part of one of the grey areas of the play. Along arrives Faye's brother, and they haven't been speaking for a while. Don't know if they've had a big row or just haven't been bothering to be in contact. And this is the character of Nisha, played by Michael Patrick, who had been in the original short version of the play
right.
You did in the international with Oisin Kearney directing.
Yeah.
And Oisin is directing here again, isn't he?
He is.
He comes with his own set of baggages, and I'm sure you don't want to give up, but he comes with big secrets as well, which play right into the power dynamics of the whole situation here as well.
Yeah, absolutely. He has ulterior motives and... Yes, they haven't been speaking in a year, so their relationship is quite stilted. But they essentially both need each other for something, so they're on their best behaviour for the most part.
And you're going to have to go and see the play if you want to find out more about it, because we will just give away too much if we start talking about it in those terms. But one thing that I did, in fact, Oisin Kearney and Michael Patrick, who you have involved in this, as well as Charlotte McCurry, who plays the character of Faye, Oisin and Michael were in with me a while back talking about, if it was 2021, they were talking about their play, The Border Game, and they certainly are quite a powerhouse together. But I also know noticed in recent times, very sad tweet or sad news from Michael Patrick, the Belfast-based Irish actor, an announcement that he made on Twitter some time back. I know you've spoken to him about this. And are you happy to tell us what he announced on Twitter and how you're dealing with that within the current production?
Yeah, certainly. So Mick is an incredible creative force, along with Oisin, and he's also a very good friend. So in February, Michael was diagnosed with motor neurons disease, which is a degenerative disease that is currently affecting his mobility, which is heartbreaking and, devastating news. But Mick's amazing. So he, after some time, he made it clear to us that he still wanted to do Lilo, the show that we all made together. And the wheels were in motion to bring it to the Peacock stage in the Abbey Theatre, and also to Edinburgh, to the Traverse Theatre for Fringe. So to make that realistic, we decided to hire a third actor, the incredible Thomas Finnegan, who would stand in and do the more physical aspects of Mick's role in the play every night. And then on alternate nights, he would take over the role of Nisha as well, to allow Mick to have some time off. And also just really the pressure in case, you know, Mick needed another night off. Or,
It has to be said that, there are some great verbal pyrotechnics within the play, but there's a lot of physicality within it as well. It demands a very, very physical performance. So did you have to adjust that slightly? Mick was quite funny. You're calling him Mick, so I'll presume that that's what he likes to be called.
Sorry, yes, Mick.
He was quite funny in his tweet about the characters that he would now like to be considered for. What adjustments did you have to make for the play, for the current production? Apart from the taking in of the new actor?
To be honest, almost none. It worked out really well. So in the play, Mick was playing two characters, Nisha, the brother, and also this character called Duckman, who appears in some of the more surreal scenes.
Yeah.
But they're very separate, and we were able to sort of separate them completely. So Thomas will play the role of Duckman, Mick plays the role of Nisha, and there were very few adjustments, if any, that we really needed to make. So we were very lucky in that regard.
Yes, indeed.
That it worked out, yeah.
Yeah, and I suppose I should explain. At Mick the Aegis is his Twitter handle, and he suggests, because there are some mobility issues with one of his legs, he suggested that he could be cast in the role of Richard III. He could be cast in the role of Raphael, the husband in Marina Carr's Portia Coughlin. There are a few others in there as well. Oh yeah, he could be cast in the role in The Cripple of Inish Man. And there are a few different suggestions that he gives.
And he means that. Yeah, he really means that.
He's both serious. Yeah, he is very serious. It's a serious pitch for the part.
Serious pitch.
But it also, I suppose, shows that he's finding a way of dealing with what must be very difficult news to get. Yeah. And there is some on his own on at Mick the Aegis. He has some links to various charities that are involved in motor neuron disease, and people can check that out for themselves. Exploring the whole idea of sexual misconduct and really what struck me reading the script, Ciara, it's as much about power as it is about anything else. And that's not a new discovery around sexual misconduct. No. But the power shifts in your play in a way that I hadn't expected.
Brilliant. I'm glad to hear it. Well, I mean, I think that's important. I think one of the things that I was cautious of was not to create a character that was able to be vilified for their behaviour, or was able to be excused, I suppose. I think what we found certainly in the last number of years, in the last decade, was that especially in an institution, it's not necessarily one person. In fact, it's almost never just one person. There's a system in place that kind of allows and abets people to you know, perpetrate that behaviour. And so I think that obviously this, I'm not dealing with an institution necessarily in the play, but I think it was important to show the good and the bad in both characters.
Yeah, but I guess
as much as possible.
Yeah, the family in some ways is a kind of an institution, and that's part of the dynamic. But I wanted to finish up with a speech that comes towards the end of the play, and it's Faye who's speaking, and she's talking about when she was younger, or at a certain point she was listening too closely. I'm looking at the script in front of me, for intonation in people's voices, totally preoccupied by their micro expressions. But she goes on to say, I learned how to turn down the noise and to actually listen carefully to what was happening in her own head. I wondered, is that something that you as a writer have to do, to learn how to turn down the noise that says, why are you saying that? Why are you writing that? Why are you putting that on the stage?
Oh, I think you found me out there, Sean.
Oh, yeah.
No, I mean, I definitely do. I think the self-doubt is constant and violent. But I suppose you do sort of have to try and turn everything down and just think that the point is the expression. It's not necessarily how or what or, you know, I'm just trying to express something honestly and as entertaining as possible, you know.
On the basis of the success of Lilo, I think you're probably managing that, given the Best New Writing Award and the several other events that are coming up. I know you have a screenplay in the offing and you have a play coming up as well, Gunanua Commission. So there's lots happening there and you've been mentored by Enda Walsh. So that must help the confidence as well.
Yeah.
Lovely to have spoken with you this evening, Ciara, and best of luck with the run in the Peacock. That's Ciara Elizabeth Smith, and her play Lilo will run at the Peacock Theatre from July the 17th through until the 29th, and abbeytheatre.ie will give you all of the details there. You're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena. Once a cheat, always a cheat. Once a cheat, always a cheat. You swear you're innocent, but that's not the case. You've got that guilt written all over your face. You busybody, you can't stay in one place. Cheat is the title of the song, and it's from an album called IRL, which of course is an abbreviation for In Real Life. It is the latest album from Mahalia, and the track there that you just heard features Jojo as well, a track called Cheat. And the Mahalia album In Real Life is one of three we will be reviewing this Friday evening alongside new releases from Rita Ora and Sam Burton. Well, sad news released today that the renowned Czech writer Milan Kundera has died at the age of 94. After a long illness. For more than half a century, he wrote poems, plays, essays and novels, including, of course, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, which became an acclaimed film starring our own Daniel Day-Lewis. Kundera left his homeland in 1975 for France and spent 40 years living in exile in Paris after his Czech citizenship was revoked. He had been thrown out of the Czechoslovakian Communist Party. So from 1995, he stopped writing in his native language and switched to French with his novel Slowness. His final novel was 2014's The Festival of Insignificance. That is Milan Kundera, whose death was announced today. He was 94. Moving to the BBC and the new drama set in the pretty village of Buckinghamshire, The Sixth Commandment is a new four-part drama which starts on BBC on Monday the 17th of July. It tells the true story of how the meeting of an inspirational teacher, Peter Farquhar, played by Timothy Spall, and a charismatic student, Ben Field, played by Anna Hardwick, set the stage for one of the most complex and confounding criminal cases in recent memories. The series is created and written by Sarah Phelps of A Very British Scandal, The Pale Horse, and much else besides. The cast includes Anne Reid, Amanda Root, and, as I said, our own Anna Hardwick. In fact, I remember when Timothy Spall was speaking to us about his recent film, he mentioned that he was shooting with the Sixth Commandment at the time with Anna Hardwick and was very complimentary about him. Declan Burke has been watching the series for us, or the first episode of the series, which is what we were allowed to watch. And he's with me in studio this evening. The Sixth Commandment is... I had to go looking this up today to check which one it was. And I was a little bit confused because it kind of can be two different ones, can't it?
Those of the Catholic faith, you know, it's thou shalt not commit adultery, Sean. Mm-hmm. So those of you who are rushing out to watch it on that basis, you will be disappointed. The Sixth Commandment in the Protestant faith is thou shalt not kill. And that is what the series revolves around.
Yeah, and we needn't get into it. It tells us at the very beginning that it is based on a true story, and it tells us that it's in memory of two people. So when you're watching, you'll get that, and lots of people will go off and Google immediately when they see those two names. But let us start with the two characters that I mentioned, the Peter Farquhar character played by Timothy Spall and the Ben Field character played by Anna Hardwick. Timothy Spall, from the outset here, you really want to put your arms around him and give him a hug and tell him, you're a gorgeous person, you're fine, don't be worrying about anything. He really evokes empathy, doesn't he?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the finest actors of his generation, I think. And in this role, he has a very difficult job to pull off and does it excellently. So in his public life, Peter Farquhar, he's quite a successful man. He's been an English teacher at Stowe School, where the students are referred to as Stoics. I quite like that. And not only is he an excellent English teacher, he has also published a novel, but he seems to be beloved by the alumni. The first episode opens with his retirement function, actually, which takes place in a church. And the place is absolutely heaving with present and past pupils. And even when the introductory speech introduces him as, you know, a man who can deliver a stinging rebuke, and when one is rebuked, one stays stung, you know, the whole place collapses in laughter. So we know we're dealing with someone who is of a certain generation. He is the stiff upper lip English gentleman. He's of a certain age. This happens in 2015, but he's into his 70s at this stage, late 60s, 70s. So he has certain, you know, principles and standards. And then the party ends and he drifts home, and we realise this is a completely different man because he lives alone. The house is well appointed, but it's dark. It's kind of claustrophobic. There isn't even a pet. He has a single bed. Your heart just breaks. And his interactions with his brother, who he gets on very well with, for example,
Adrian Rowlands.
He you know, he's confident and he's outgoing, but when he finds himself in a situation where even the possibility of affection might arise, he almost seems to shrivel up on screen. It's actually kind of a masterclass to watch it. And as you say, you just want to reach out and touch this guy on the shoulder and tell him it'll be okay.
And he's open about his homosexuality, but his religious beliefs will not let him follow through on any expression of that physically or sexually.
Well, he's open in a certain way. So he has a brilliant relationship with his pastor, his confessor, who's played by John Bard, who has a really nice role. So he can talk directly to him and has obviously confessed he needs to
And he's open with his brother and his family.
His brother and his sister-in-law are also aware. But as far as the wider public are concerned, he's closeted effectively and always has. And in part it's to do with his public role. But you're right, it's completely to do with his perception of his religious faith.
Enter Ben Field, one of his students, and as far as Peter Farquhar, the Timothy Spall character, can ascertain, exactly the type of young man that the church needs. He's quite the character. This Ian Hardwick guy.
Ian Hardwick, look, we here in Ireland, we know what he's like. He's a terrific, terrific actor. Again, he has a very difficult role in this because he's playing against what the public knows of the real life Ben Fields. Just this guy just glides onto screen. When he comes on, he's wearing kind of hiking gear. He's late to class, and he is the ideal that Peter Farquhar sees as a young man should be. And then we see the glinting cross hanging from his neck, and all of a sudden, oh, this man is the perfect package.
Yeah, Peter Farquhar is intellectually very
brilliant.
Bright.
He even writes poetry himself. He's a terrific English student. He's insightful and he's kind. He's generous and he's gentle. I mean, you know, I was nearly falling for the guy myself as 20 minutes of the programme elapsed.
Let's listen to a scene between Timothy Spall and Anna Hardwick. The character of Ben Fields has come around for tea and is speaking to Peter Farquhar in the front sitting room of that very well appointed house, as you expressed it, Declan.
So you help with your girlfriend's son? It's very thoughtful.
Oh, he's such a great kid, and you know, I like to help. I like to take care. What about you? Do you have a partner?
No, I never married.
I didn't mean that. I wondered if you had a man to share your life with.
I didn't think I was that obvious.
You're not.
Well, then you're a very perceptive young man. But in answer to your question, no, I'm very much a single man.
I think that's a shame. It's lovely here. Yeah. So peaceful.
A bit too peaceful sometimes. I used to take in lodgers. I'm thinking about doing it again.
Might be able to help you with that.
I don't know if I want his help. That's Ina Hardwick as Ben Field, who might be able to help Peter Farker, the Timothy Spall character, with his searching for a lodger. I mean, but it gives you a real sense of the insidious nature of the character as played by Ina Hardwick. Nice as pie, but knows when to just drop the little bombshell.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, he's a brilliant sociopath, if that's not a paradox, if I can use that phrase. Even the timbre of Ina Hardwick's voice there that we can hear in the audio, there is a compelling, persuasive quality to this person. And he is brilliant at seeking out what it is you need and then just gently giving it back to you. Not making a song and dance out of it very quietly. Oh, you need a lodger. Oh, I think I might be able to help you with that. Cut to lodger walks through the front door. But there's no histrionics from Ina Hardwick. This is all very understated, very low key and deliciously, chillingly, but deliciously delivered.
As you say, he is so plausible as the good guy that you kind of, it's a very clever, clever piece of acting. But we get the sense there that he has discovered for himself or worked out that Peter Farquhar is gay, and therefore is going to exploit that particular aspect of the man's character as well. But that gayness is the subject, and the religion, it's the subject of quite a lengthy discursive section between, you mentioned the confessor there.
It's his pastor, who's actually never named in the first episode, but played by John Bard. And I think this scene, as you say, is quite lengthy. It goes on for 6 or 7 minutes. And I think it's at the core of not just this first episode, but who Peter Farquhar is, because Peter has previously confessed he feels that he needs to confess that he's gay, for example, and says that he needs to be quote unquote punished, and that he is a quote squalid witness for Christ because he looks at websites of young men hiking up mountains. This is how deviant his sin is, or not, as the case would be. And the pastor is incredibly understanding and wants him to believe that regardless of his sexuality, God will love him, and no matter how he expresses himself. The crux of it is that Peter refuses to believe that.
Peter's argument is, isn't it, you know, Christ might still love me or God might still love me, but what about the church? I've sinned against the church. So he's very
absolutely
much following the rule of law.
There's a certain amount of social status to go. Where will he go? Because he's a lay preacher if he is, you know, rejected by his church. But this man is also a man of principles and deep faith.
Yeah.
And he lives his life within the church. This is as much a part of his being as his sexuality. So it's a fantastic seeing that. And as I say, if you get under the skin of that scene, I think you're absolutely hooked by this.
And also the fact that he has these discussions with his pastor, the fact that his brother and his sister-in-law, it's a very small community. This is a little, it's a little rural village idyll. You know, it's the perfect Buckinghamshire village, you would think.
In theory, it is. The village of Maids Morton, which is as middle England, I think, as it gets. But it is. It's a beautiful pastoral setting. You know, these lovely cul-de-sacs of manicured gardens, and there's a little church in the corner, and you know, we don't get to see any cricket on the village green, but I'm sure it happens. So it's that kind of beautiful, as you say, idyll, and then this character of Benfield comes almost slinking into it, you know, seeping his poison
with a sidekick, with a pal, Conor McNeil, another Irish actor, the character of Martin, who seems to be a sidekick in there, also of a dubious nature.
Martin is the promised lodger and moves in as also a student of Peter Farquhar. Actually, the character of Martin is quite a sympathetic character, is quite a nice, and seems to be wondering what is Ben's motive, what is his...
Easily manipulated, I would think, is the character
I would have
of Martin.
Thought so, but a very pleasant character and one that we hope will, you know, maybe rescue Peter from the peril that he has found himself
and
in.
And others in the village who are going to be in trouble too. You've seen one episode, can you wait to see the next three?
Well, I can't really, to be honest. And the good news is the second episode is on...
On the same night?
I think it's the following night.
Oh, sorry,
it's a Monday
and
Tuesday thing. So I won't have too long to wait. No, I think this is very strong. There's great writing here. It's two terrific performances. I can only assume that all that, and the direction, by the way, very deft, very
yeah,
nice.
Yeah, it is. Certainly the first episode was very engaging. The Sixth Commandment begins 9 p.m. BBC One on Monday the 17th of July. That is what Declan Burke was speaking to us about this evening, and that is our lot for this Wednesday evening. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Paula Shields and Amandine Passo-Devine were the researchers. Aisling Grufferty was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1, and John Crean will be with you after the news.